live as I record this. It's the Mike Novak Show. Neither fish nor fowl. It's actually a planty kind of tofu-like program that goes well with red and white wine, a nice lager beer, or even a wholesome glass of chocolate goat's milk. So have a sip and sing along.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
And thank you, Hillbilly Winos, for that stirring rendition. Someday I will tell you the story of my show theme, and yes, it really is performed by a group called the Hillbilly Winos. That in itself is a story. And thank you for tuning in, however you're listening, the Green Divas Global Digital Network at ggdradio.com, iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, SoundCloud, the GLN Radio Network, and of course, at mikenovak.net. There's more at The Mike Novak Show on Facebook and on Twitter. You can find me with the handle at Mike Now. Drop me a line anytime you like, Mike at mikenovak.net. I have three separate segments on the show today, and for the first two, I go north of the border to Ontario, Canada, the east side of the province, and then to the west side. I start with a phone visit to a place called Amherst Island in Lake Ontario, which is part of the Thousand Islands chain in the St. Lawrence Seaway. There I talk to an old friend of mine, Mayo Underwood, and yes, her first name is actually spelled M-A-Y-O. There's a plan to put wind turbines on the island, which is being fought by several conservation organizations, as well as the inhabitants of the island. Now, as a supporter of renewable energy, I'm all for wind turbines in most cases. But there is the question of bird and bat mortality in the area of wind farms, especially those along migratory corridors. And the Great Lakes are known to be prime migratory areas. Mayo will have more about that controversy. Then I go to another Great Lake, Superior, and the city of Thunder Bay, which, as it turns out, is a lot larger than I knew. I talked to Pam Tallon, who has a blog called Growing North, and who isn't deterred by Ontario's winters when it comes to growing vegetables. She tells me how she does it, and how folks in northern climes can have fresh produce even when it's below freezing outside. The third segment is a follow-up to a story I did several weeks ago at the Chicago Botanic Garden. You might remember that folks there were all a Twitter, and I don't mean the social medium, because their Titan arum, named Spike, was about to bloom, releasing its scent of rotting flesh. Nice. One of those plants had just bloomed in Denver, and it looked as though we were about to have a double dip. Then, well, a bit of a disappointment. Spike did not bloom. In the end, however, it was almost as interesting, kind of a science experiment. I talked to Tim Pollock, who raised the plant for a dozen years, about what the Chicago Botanic Garden learned from the near miss. Meanwhile, you can get more information about anything you hear on my show at mikenovak.net, mikenowak.net. There are links and photos and often commentary, which I hope you take advantage of. So let's get to today's show, which is right after this.
Hi, I'm Peggy, and I have great news. Natural Awakenings, Chicagoland's only monthly magazine dedicated to healthy and green living, is now available throughout Cook and Lake Counties. We feature articles about fitness, local food and drink, gardening and environment, green energy, healthy kids and families, even healthy pets. Natural Awakenings is free and available throughout the city and suburbs or online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Because it's the new Mother Nature taking over. It's the new Splendid Lady come to call. It's the new Mother Nature taking over. She's getting us all.
It's the Mike Novak Show. Thank you for joining me. And I seem to have a kind of Canada connection today. In this segment, I'm going to Ontario via phone, of course, to Amherst Island, which is in Lake Ontario. I'll tell you more about that in a second. And then later in the show, I'm going west to Lake Superior, to the western shore of Lake Superior, and a place called Thunder Bay, where I'll be talking to a woman named Pam Tallon, who's growing vegetables in the winter. And if you can do it in Ontario in the winter, you can do it anywhere. That's going to be an interesting conversation. But let's go back to Lake Ontario and Amherst Island to bring in an old friend of mine, Mayo Underwood. Mayo, how are you?
I'm doing great, Mike. How are you?
Fabulous. I note that today there's a nip in the air in Chicago, but I imagine on Amherst Island you get that often.
Actually, we pretty much get your weather when you're through with it.
When we discard it, we send it to Amherst Island. And folks should know that Amherst Island is on the eastern part of Lake Ontario, and you're basically the start of the Thousand Islands chain, right?
Correct. Well, the Thousand Islands, they count it the way the river flows and the water first hits the island. So the first island it hits is our island, so we're number one. But I think we're number one anyway.
And you're one of the largest, too, aren't you?
Yes. There's some of them that are like the size of a living room, and there's some of them that the one next to us, Wolf Island, is quite a bit larger with towns on it. We have 400 residents, and our town of Stella has probably 20 homes in it.
And you don't have all that many people, even though the island is fairly significant in size, you don't have all that many people living there permanently.
No, there's 400 permanent residents, and it can double or triple in the summertime when people come for their cottages or whatever, or to visit. But no, it's 400 of us, and we get to the mainland by ferry.
Now,
or by private boat, whatever.
Yeah, private boat ferry. Do you have any, is there an airstrip on the island?
No. Okay. There's not a store, not a gas station, nothing but residences.
Really? So really? None of that.
I know. We have electricity, we have Wi-Fi, and we often have telephone, so we're good.
Well, you have telephone today, which is great.
Yes.
And as you mentioned, there's a storm moving through, so we'll see what happens.
Correct.
Now, Mayo and I go back to her days in Chicago, in the Chicago area, when you ran
Underwood Gardens.
Underwood Gardens, which you can still find at underwoodgardens.com.
Correct.
And you were a seed producer and sold them, and I have bought seeds from you, and very cool stuff. And do you miss that?
I do. However, the people here, when I moved here, I brought about 600 varieties of seeds with me. Thank God Doug, who's my better half, is also a gardener, and he thought it was rather fun. And so I still grow weird things and get weird things and share them with the people on the island. So everybody's got, whether it's a black tomato or a, you know, purple pepper, whatever, they're all happy with them.
I remember in particular a tomato called Mrs. Benson's.
Yes.
Which is a wonderful tomato. I haven't grown it in a while, but it's a terrific tomato.
There's another one. I will have to send you some seeds. The industry named it after me. It's called Mayo's Delight.
Oh, that's great. I didn't realize that.
It is phenomenal, if I do say so myself. So I will send you some seeds, Mike.
Well, I have to, since you get your own tomato, I got to give you a ding there. So now, the reason we're talking, though, isn't about seed starting or growing things. It's about the island and wind turbines. Some people say wind turbines. I have always said turban, and then my friends say, well, that's something you wear on your head.
Right, that's what we've been told, too, so we call them turbines.
Turbines, okay, just to be clear about it. And there's a project in Ontario to put some turbines on Amherst Island, and you guys are fighting it. And this is it's an issue that I have been aware of before, because I have received emails from the American Bird Conservancy, and they have been fighting turbines in a lot of places. And that itself is interesting, because I'm a proponent of green energy, and wind turbines, as we know, don't pollute our environment the way that fossil fuels do. And yet there is controversy surrounding wind energy, and one of them is one of the problems you have with wind energy is siting. And Amherst Island is one of those problems, I guess, and one of those areas where there is controversy. Can you explain that a little bit, Mayo?
Well, you've really encapsulated it well. Many environmentalists believe that wind energy is the way to go, and there's many who believe it's a transition energy because it cannot sustain itself when the wind is not blowing. You don't get energy, you don't get power, and there's no way to store it. So you must have fossil fuel backup, and to start them up at a moment's notice is hard on the environment and on the pocketbook. So there's controversy about that. But whether it's something people want or don't want, the proper siting of turbines, of wind turbines, is what is concerning most of the places like American Bird Conservancy and Nature Ontario and whatever. Because if they site them on migratory paths, the birds and bats both suffer great losses from the blades, and with bats, from barotrauma, which means they basically get near them and with a change in barometric pressure, they implode and die.
Yeah, I read about that the other day, and that is pretty gruesome.
It is.
And you should know, one of the things I was checking out in anticipation of our conversation was, you know, what kind of technology is being developed. And the folks who are using wind turbines have looked at a lot of different things and are developing a lot of different ways to make them safer for animals, the flying animals, bats and birds, and smarter siting is numero uno. That's at the top of the list, is, you know, because there's been controversy about siting in California and killing golden eagles,
right,
in California. So that's it. But when you mention bats, they are trying to do ultrasound, you know, have ultrasound around some of these wind turbines to chase the bats away, having the wind turbines not be active when the winds are very, very low, you know, because bats like flying in very low wind conditions. So there are things that can be done, but it sounds like the first priority in your case is not to site it on Amherst, because well, there are reason, migratory routes there, but also cultural reasons, the island itself.
Right. You've got it in again. And there's other things, too. When they construct wind turbines, they're huge, as you understand. These will be, the ones here is purported to be about 55 stories tall. And then they're enormous. And the bases for them and the roads needed to transport their parts, the roads have to be reconstructed, the areas have to be dug, and the ground nesting birds like bobolink and meadowlark have all their habitats destroyed. And so those are thriving here as is no place else in Ontario, and they are endangered. And so they're saying, well, go ahead, build anyway, we'll mitigate, we'll move them. Well, how do you move a bird that's nesting and comes back here? There's many, many ways that this doesn't work. With the cultural heritage, the old dry stone wall fences, which were built maybe 200 years ago by the Irish settlers, have no mortar, and the vibrations of the trucks will make them collapse. As the stone foundations of this place, too, on many of the homes are built up to the laneways. We don't have roads. We have laneways, most of them not paved. yet they want to widen these and bring down turbine parts, which are huge. So the vibrations there and the widening will destroy the home. There's 400 residents. It almost feels like the developer is saying, well, there's nobody there that counts. And I'm sorry, I'm sure that's not the case, but that's what it seems like. The other problem that we see is blocking these roads or changing them with large turbine parts. We have no hospitals. We have a volunteer fire department and what we call first responders who pick up somebody on the island, do a great job until the ambulance can get over on the ferry and get somebody to a hospital. If a road is blocked, fire equipment cannot get through, nor can the first responders, and they cannot get to the person. Ontario has told the developer it has to have an emergency plan in place. The developer has not said, oh, we'll do that, don't worry, and Ontario improved it, said go ahead and build. So there's many reasons that we're concerned,
yeah,
as you might gather.
Yeah, and this has been approved by, of course, in the United States, we have the Environmental Protection Agency, but in Canada, you have the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change.
And that's the one that approved it.
Uh-huh. And it seems odd that they wouldn't have taken these considerations to heart. From what I understand, this battle is now in the courts.
It is about to go. They approved it on September 1st, and we were allowed, in the middle of September, and we were allowed 15 days to get all the paperwork ready for an appeal, which we had managed to delay for over 500 days, which was unheard of in Ontario. They usually get the approval and go. So we had it in the technical review stage for 500-plus days, all the while preparing what we would have to do in 15 days, which is a lot more than 15 days work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have the appeal in place in time, and now it goes to the courts.
Well, you know, it sounds to me, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier, is I'm a fan of clean energy, but there's the right place for it. And you look at Canada, the country of Canada, you guys have a lot of open spaces there, all right?
Yes.
And a lot of open spaces where the wind blows, and a lot of open spaces where there are not the same kind of migratory bird routes. Let's face it, you're on the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Great Lakes Path, all right?
Correct.
Everybody knows, I mean, in Chicago here, we know that where do birds travel? They come down Lake Michigan because it's part of the Great Lakes, and you have to be careful about that. I don't understand why Canada, the government of Canada, can't figure that out, that this might be a problem, especially since, from what I understand, your nearby Wolf Lake has some turbines and they've caused deaths to a number of birds.
Oh, you see, you've gotten it all. You've done your homework, Mike. This is a major Atlantic Migratory Freeway, a flyway freeway, listen to me.
Well, it's a freeway for birds, okay?
It is a freeway for birds. Plus, this is where the Arctic owls overwinter. And the owls on Wolf Island, which is next door, they have very few jobs, as were promised by the turbines. They have 1.5 or 2.5 jobs, and the main jobs are picking up dead birds. And we have pictures of people with these gorgeous owls, huge owls, that are just a bloody mess.
Oh, dear.
And it's really heartbreaking. And yet the turbine developer, they come once a week and they look about 50 feet around the turbines and they say, oh, there's 2 dead birds. That's all. They haven't seen anything else. They don't manage to. And they're cleaned up. So it's like, no, there's not that many bird kill. It's really sad.
Well, and again, to be fair, many, many, many times more birds are killed by buildings in major metropolitan areas. But as we increase the number of turbines that we put in for clean energy, this is going to continue to be a problem if we can't solve this. And
yeah.
I agree that there are some places that should not have the turbines. And this sounds like it's one of them. Now, if folks want to get involved in this, have you guys gotten your a website or Facebook page or something together?
We have named ourselves the Association to Protect Amherst Island. And it was not built for this. It was to get all kinds of other good things going here. And this is where we have gotten stuck, sadly enough. So the website is protectamherstisland.com.
Okay, protectamherstisland.com. And, of course, I will put it on my website, mikenovak.net, so folks can track it down there. And Amherst is spelled A-M-H-E-R-S-T. Right. Oh, I can hear your chimes going off.
Oh, Doug's father collected clocks, and we still have way too many of them. And yeah, I've gotten to the point I don't hear them, but everybody else does. Okay, on Facebook, it is called Association to Protect Amherst Island.
Okay.
If you get to the right one, you'll see a big, beautiful picture of a snowy owl coming toward you.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go. And so folks are interested, they can go to Association to Protect Amherst Island, or they can go to, now I've got to find it because I'm going back and forth on my computer here, protectamherstisland.com.
Correct. And the one on Facebook, the first thing you see, the first posting is what you can do to help save. And there's a please, you know, write or email or call the head of Ontario, who's Kathleen Wynne, and say, please don't do this. Because I think the more calls and letters they get, that's what happened when they had a comment period, which is why we delayed them for 500 days. So many people contacted them. And now some people in Spain, some birders in Spain who have contacts with the UN, and these birders are up in arms because of the owls. And, I mean, let's face it, Mike, buildings may kill birds, but they don't kill owls and raptors. They don't fly into them. So this is the larger species, like the owls and raptors, do not produce enough offspring to withstand this kind of kill.
Yeah.
So these birders are upset, and they have connections in the UN, and they say Ontario is allowing birds to be killed that are not their birds. They belong to the U.S., they belong to Mexico and the world, and they cannot allow this. So there may be some complaint to the UN, which I think is pretty astounding.
That is. Yes. And I think, as the American Bird Conservancy has pointed out, it seems as though the government of Canada isn't really paying attention to international migratory laws.
We're talking about Ontario that's allowing this, and Canada is the overriding. So that's like if Illinois were allowing something, the government says no, but sometimes they don't listen. So Canada signed a migratory treaty with Mexico and the U.S. in September. In April, that says we will not do this, but there's no teeth to enforce it. There's no way to enforce it. So it's a feel-good treaty, which is sad, but I'd love to get somebody, and that was a Canadian one, not an Ontario one.
Yeah.
So right. It should be overriding, but Ontario seems to be ignoring it, and that's where you want to ask Kathleen Wynne why.
All right. Well, Mayo Underwood, good on you for fighting the good fight and trying to protect our birds and bats and other creatures and the heritage of Amherst Island. And folks, again, if they're interested in this, go to my website, mikenovak.net, and you will find the links to protectamherstisland.com and the Facebook page, which I am looking up here, which is the Association to Protect Amherst Island.
You are good.
Yeah, well, sometimes if I'm looking at my cheat sheet here. Mayo, great talking to you again.
You too, Mike. Give my best to Kathleen. And why don't you guys come up and see it for yourself?
That sounds great. I would love to do that. All right, take care.
You take care. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A+ by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Gardeners are smart. Now, why do I say that? Well, gardeners know that if they live, say, in Chicago, in USDA Hardiness Zone 5B or 6A,
they can grow plants that are suited to zones 5B or 6A. If they live in Denver, Colorado, where the zones are basically 5B and 6A, they're going to have some of the same success. That's why a publication like Chicagoland Gardening Magazine is useful in a lot of places in this country. It covers zones from about 4A to 6B, and that's a lot of area. It also has my column on the inside back page of every issue, and even that is transferable from state to state without a license. And speaking of state by state, that's the name of the outfit that publishes Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. They have 21 different publications in the Midwest and the South. Subscribe today by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600. Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show. I'm so glad you're with me again. If you ever have any questions about the stuff we talk about here, you can go to my website, mikenowak.net, mikenowak.net, and I have links and photos and information. I found myself going north, north of the border into Canada, not with just with this segment, but with my segment with Mayo Underwood, which I hope you just heard. But now we're going a little bit west of where Mayo is to the shores of Lake Superior, the western shores of Lake Superior, in a place called Thunder Bay, which is one of the best names ever for a place to live, and bring in a woman named Pam Talon. And Pam, hi, how are you?
Hi, Mike. How's it going?
It's going great, and I'm so glad to have you on the program. And Pam, now, you got to understand, Pam and I have known each other a long time. I believe about 4 days, something like that?
I think something along 4 days if we count on internet time. Sure.
Yeah, which is a lifetime. And I'm not even sure. I don't even remember 4 days later how it is that you got on my radar. But I saw that, your Twitter handle is Growing North. So for those of you on Twitter and you want to bring Growing North into the fold, that's where you go. That's the handle. Pam is a blogger, and as I said, she's on Twitter and she's on Facebook, but more importantly, she grows stuff. And that can be a challenge in Ontario. It can be a challenge on the shores of Lake Superior. And that's what caught my attention, because there was some information there. I happened to click on your blog, Pam, and I saw photos of outdoor greenhouses, little ones, you know, hoop houses and that sort of thing, and cold frames with snow on them. And it reminded me of my friend Nikki Jabour, who is in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and does a lot of the same thing. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And so we're heading into September, and in Chicago, the hawk is starting to talk. The winds have just started whistling in, and you can feel autumn, you know, out of the blue. It was 90 degrees a few days ago, and now it's in the 60s, and you go, okay, I'm ready for this, or you better be ready for this. So I thought, let's talk to Pam. For those of you folks who have always thought about growing stuff in the winter, and I'm not talking about tropical plants indoors. Anybody can do that. I'm talking about vegetables. Things you can eat. And this is something that has captivated you, hasn't it, Pam?
Well, especially in the north. I mean, if you're not growing food, you have to bring it in from somewhere, and the weather's getting more extreme. So when those roads are closed, you don't really know if you're going to have fresh lettuce. You don't know where your next fresh food is coming from.
Well, let me ask you about that. In Thunder Bay, do you get a lot of that? I mean, you talk in your blog about being an urban gardener.
And I have to ask you, how many people are there in Thunder Bay?
Well, it fluctuates. I don't know the exact numbers right now, but I think it usually is around 130,000. So we're not tiny.
No, you're not at all.
If you go 20 minutes in any direction, though, you're in the middle of virgin woods. That's it. There's nothing else around us.
And that's the difference, is that you can go from 130,000 people to wilderness if in Chicago. And you said, how fast can you do that?
20 minutes. You're in the middle of nowhere with rivers that you could drink out of.
Right. In 20 minutes, you can't even get out of the city of Chicago. Okay, basically. And when you do, you go another 20 minutes and you're in Schaumburg. All right. Which is just a close by suburb, meaning it takes forever to get to the wilderness, and there's not much of it in Illinois. What you get to is farmland in Illinois. So that's the difference. But you truly are an urban gardener, because that's a real city. And I had no idea that Thunder Bay had so many people. And how is it you became interested in growing your own stuff?
Well, I've always just enjoyed it. I like playing around with things. I'm actually I'm a microbiologist by trade. I'm a researcher. So I love working with the soil. I love understanding plants and nature, and it just tastes better.
Hey, but you know what? Now you've intrigued me even more. Well, anytime I get to talk to a microbiologist, that's pretty cool. And that adds another dimension to what you do that makes me even more impressed. So here we are coming to the winter, and folks say, I want to grow stuff indoors. What's the basic advice you give them for that, Pam Tallon?
Well, I usually tell them that they already know everything that they need to know. They learned it back in elementary school. What are the basics that a plant needs is soil, light, and water. Like, so as long as you can provide that to your plant, it doesn't matter what plant it is, you can grow it. Lettuce is just another plant. It's leaves. So you grow it and you eat it.
You're making it sound too simple. And I've read on your blog, you say you kind of rail against people who say they have black thumbs and can't grow anything. And you're out to teach them that, no, that's not true. You can actually grow something.
Absolutely. I've had a number of people who have complained about black thumbs, or who also have come to me and said, I've never grown anything in my life. What do you do? And they're treating it like it's a black magic. And so it's just, okay, well, let's grab some seeds, remind people that they need soil, light, and water, and, you know, obviously the right temperature. You can't grow it in your freezer. But let's put the soil down. Let's put the seeds in, and I'll usually coach them through it. And very quickly, in fact, they start seeing their sprouts come up. They get excited, and they realize it's not black magic. I just grew my own plant.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is. It's that easy. You just have to admit that you already know what you're doing and accept that you will have a couple failures, and don't get scared by them.
Well, but I think the thing that intimidates people is the idea of having, like you do, a hoop house or a cold frame outdoors, and I saw photographs of snow on top of them, but obviously on the inside things are growing. How do you get them started on that? And what do you tell them? Because up in Thunder Bay, you're getting a lot less sun than we're even getting in Chicago, and we're getting a lot less sun than folks are getting in California or Florida over the winter. What's the difference between trying to grow things outdoors in a frame like that and indoors where you're going to have artificial light?
The type of plant that you can grow. That it really comes down to the type of plant you can grow. Lettuce requires a certain temperature and a certain amount of light, but it's actually much, much lower. If you wanted to grow, say, spinach, you can grow it at a cold temperature, but it needs more light.
Mm-hmm.
It's happy to survive and live at our winter levels of light, say in Chicago or in Thunder Bay, but it's just going to stay there stagnant and dormant and just say, I'm alive, but I don't have enough light to do anything. But if you bring that into your house, obviously you can add artificial light. So what I've found through trying different plants is the Asian greens don't tend to care too much about how much light they have.
Ah.
They're good in the cold temperatures, and they're happy to just keep growing even though there's not much light.
All right, so give me some examples of those that you grow outdoors?
In the greenhouse I have, which is kind of an outdoors, but obviously enclosed, in there I will grow things like pak choi. Arugula is an absolute winner. Arugula grows like crazy. A few things like Hakurai turnips. They're an Asian turnip, which have a really small little bulb on them. It's really quite sweet. And the leaf is not fuzzy. It's a smooth leaf, so it's quite edible. And, oh, geez, what else have I grown there? Lots of radishes. Winter radishes are such a treat. You should try them.
Really? So radishes will do okay, eh?
Radishes will do okay. Not in the depth of winter, but in the early season and as it gets closer to spring. So late fall, early winter. And late winter, early spring, the radishes seem to get enough light to form a nice bulb. And they're really, really tasty, I have to admit that. They're so much nicer when they're growing in cold temperatures than in warm temperature.
Yeah, there are some plants that just do not like warm temperatures at all. And that's why you grow them in the spring or you grow them in the fall. So, all right, here we are in September. And what is it you're planting now and where are you doing it? You doing it indoors or outdoors?
I'm doing a combination. I'm assuming when you say outdoors, you're meaning like my greenhouse.
Right. I'm sorry. Yes, I should say that. Right.
Yeah. So outdoors, I'm getting ready to get some seed starts going so they have enough time to get some size while there's still enough light out there. Because growing lettuce early is great. It'll get enough size. And then you just kind of eat it through the winter when it's not growing too much, but it's still perfectly tasty and fresh. Then later in the season, I'll grow a few more things, plant them in. I'm finishing off right now, actually, the summer tomatoes, peppers, and melons. And they were in the greenhouse, a little bit more tropical because our summers still aren't quite what they are in the south.
So how long will you be harvesting tomatoes?
Well, right now, anything outside, I maybe have a few more weeks left for anything that is outside of the greenhouse. There are a few things there. I've got little row covers on top of them to protect from the frost that we're already getting.
Yeah. What about inside the greenhouse?
Inside the greenhouse, I've topped those plants because I don't want them taking up too much of my winter green space. And so they're not going to grow any additional tomatoes. Those last tomatoes should finish up in about a month and a half.
That's still pretty good. When you consider, I had a conversation with a guy a few weeks ago who's trying to grow the perfect tomato, Dr. Harry Klee down at the University of Florida. And he said... somebody, you know, people tell him that, hey, I don't need the store-bought tomato. I can grow my own heirlooms. And he said, yeah, and you get them for exactly 2 months of the year. It sounds like you've already extended the season.
A greenhouse will do that for almost everybody because you control the climate more, right? You have control.
Right, right.
Not to the same extent of, say, like a research facility or, you know, a commercial greenhouse, but by just having a greenhouse, even if it's not a winter-level greenhouse, just a small summer one with a little bit of plastic, you're already extending yourself by about 3 weeks in either direction.
So so what about the spring then? You know, you said you've got some things you do now and you grow them into the winter. The dead of winter is really tough. When in the winter do you start preparing and start growing your seeds so that they can take advantage of the increased light of late winter, early spring?
I sort of stagger that through, and I experiment with it all the time, so I don't have an absolute time or date on that. I'm still having fun with what will grow and what won't grow. I won't plant radishes right in the middle of winter in the greenhouse to eat because they won't grow. Spinach, I'll start, I'd say maybe end of January. I'll start planting in some additional spinach because then the light is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And when that light is increasing far enough, the spinach is actually going to take advantage of it and grow. If I planted that, say, at the beginning of December, it's just going to sit there. It won't do anything.
Hmm. Well, that's good information to know. A lot of folks, it could save them some heartache knowing that there are absolutes, the absolute times that you can't really put anything in your greenhouse. What about indoors, though? That's got to be a little bit different. And what kind of grow lights do you use?
Well, I'm not trying to grow anything that's fruiting. So I'm not trying to grow anything indoors like a pepper or a tomato, which need a pretty high-intensity light. They need full sunlight, photon. Whereas I'm growing things like lettuce. They don't need a lot of light, just a certain number of hours. So plain old fluorescent lights, full spectrum fluorescent lights from your local hardware store are perfect.
Except, and I've used those too, and I would, and the caveat I would use is that folks don't understand how close you actually have to put them to the plants.
Exactly. I think I've tried to focus on that in the blog when I'm, you know, things that would trip you up. Here, don't do this. This is going to be like your kind of, most people who start off not knowing what they're doing will put the lights super high. You need them almost a couple inches, not even, maybe an inch above the plants, because like we discussed, the photon energy is just not there. There's light, but it's not very high intensity, so you need them pretty close. You're right.
But it's good to hear that you don't go in for the fancy stuff, that you just say, you know, plain old shop light, and people have said this for years. Do you go for full spectrum?
I do go for full spectrum because I like to experiment even with that, and a couple things like a bit of extra. You can do radishes under a grow light.
Mm-hmm.
I've done them. But I have heard a number of people who don't use a full spectrum, and I don't see a problem with that. It could also be because I use my same grow table to do some spring seed starts for my outside summer plants. I have to start my tomatoes by April, but there's no way I could put them outside in the snow. So I'm using some of those indoor grow lights to get them started, and they need a bit more of the spectrum.
Well, there's so much more I want to ask you, and I got a feeling we are going to need to have more conversations, Pam. If you want to find out more about Pam Tallon, you can go to growingnorth.ca, and you can go to her Twitter handle, which is Growing North, at Growing North, and your Facebook page, which is Growing North. It's all pretty easy to find. You're branding yourself very well there, Pam.
Thank you. Not too many people are trying to grow in the North, so it was pretty easy.
I know. Isn't that something? And you're the trendsetter. And I want to talk more about this and especially get into things like I loved your post about aphids in the greenhouse. Last year, and how you had to deal with those. And you went to biological controls, which I appreciate because I'm not really a chemical guy. And you did that, and it took a lot longer than you thought, and you had mishaps along the way. But you learned a lot, didn't you?
I did, and I learned that I absolutely love those biological controls. But yeah, they're definitely not a indeterminate, just spray it and it's dead kind of thing. They need their own time to work. It's kind of like, you know, trying to tell a woman what to do. We'll get there eventually in our own way.
Folks, notice that I did not say that. Pam said that. Okay. So I don't want any nasty cards and letters and phone calls.
No, I said that one. That one was me.
That was her.
It's more like trying to tell me what to do.
Yes.
How about I put it that way?
Okay, exactly. Pam Tallon of Growing North, thank you so much. We are going to talk again, okay? And good luck with the vegetables as we head into the winter season. And I will check back with you, see what you have.
Sounds good, Mike. You enjoy your fall.
I shall.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
Did you know that fall is a great time to improve your lawn while being kind to the environment? Lawns do better with some nourishment over the colder months, like Milorganite Organic Nitrogen Fertilizer. Milorganite applied in fall will help your lawn green up faster next spring and help it recover quickly from winter damage. Proper fertilization will improve your lawn's overall health and reduce weed problems. Give your lawn the food it needs. Milorganite for better results naturally. Visit Milorganite.com for a garden center near you.
Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show. Thank you for being with me. A few weeks ago, I did a couple of segments about an event at the Chicago Botanic Garden. It seems there was this plant, and the plant was named Spike. Spike is something that's called Amorphophallus titanium. Yes, Amorphophallus. Which I have to throw in there just to diffuse, well, maybe encourage you to go to go down the wrong road in the way you think about it. Actually, I happen to own an Amorphophallus. Mine's not as big as the one at the Chicago Botanic Garden. Okay. I'll try to stop. But the point is, it's a tropical plant. They're not usually as big as, you know, you just can't even talk about this without having to do that. But at any rate, I do have one of those plants at home, and it's a tropical plant, and I have it in a little container, and I grow it each year. In the fall, it dies back, the leaves drop down, and it goes dormant for the winter. And then in the spring, it sends up shoots again, and I put it out on the back porch where it's warmer and it's got a little more sun, actually more light because I don't have direct sun on the back porch. And I grow it for the summer, and then it goes dormant again and over again each year. Same thing happens at these botanic gardens that grow these plants. The difference is theirs are much larger, as I said before, without the rim shot. And they grow from something called corms. Now, if you've ever grown a tulip or a gladiolus or a daffodil in your backyard, and the gladiolus is the perfect example because they grow from corms. And these Titan arums grow from corms also, except the corms are like on steroids. And in the spring, the warmth of the soil causes the leaves to sprout and then flower. In the case of these botanic gardens, however, they're very large, and the Titan arums don't bloom every year. They bloom maybe once a decade, so it's a big deal. And the other thing that happens when they bloom is they produce a scent that smells like rotting flesh. Maybe I should do it now, too. Yes, rotting flesh. And that's to attract the pollinators, which are carrion beetles and flies, that will pollinate other Titan arums. These are in the tropics, Sumatra. Now, Tim Pollock is the guy who raised Spike, which is the name of the plant at the Chicago Botanic Garden. And he's been doing it for 12 years. In Denver, at the Denver Botanic Gardens this summer, one of those Titan arums bloomed, releasing its scent. People lined up for hours just to see it. Well, the one at the Chicago Botanic Garden started to bloom, and the word got out, and people started coming by to see the plant. Even before it bloomed, they wanted to see the bloom starting to open up, and there was a live camera shot, which you could follow on YouTube. They had press reports, and everybody was ready for it to bloom and follow the bloom at the Denver Botanic Gardens, except it did not bloom. Now, it sounds like that might have been a catastrophe, except 75,000 people either came as it was trying to bloom or afterward when they took it apart to see what had happened. I went there the morning that they invited the public after they announced that it was not going to bloom. And I talked to Tim Pollock, the guy who had raised it and grown it. And that's the conversation coming up next. You might notice that there are hundreds of people there. You can hear them in the interview. And Tim was pretty... Tim hadn't had any sleep in a while. But he was a champ. He just powered through it all and talked to anybody who would listen. And I want to thank him for the time he took with me. And then I ducked out of there because I knew he was going to be there a long, long time.
Tim.
Yeah.
When did you make your determination that this just wasn't going to happen? And what led you to that conclusion?
The fact that it was getting, Spike was getting older than what we thought when he was normally going to bloom. And again, you know, normal, we gave him a range. And by Tuesday, there was some, you know, some curious thoughts here, what was going on. But Wednesday evening and into Thursday, we noticed that the top of the spathe here was starting to wilt. And wilting, it's not necessarily the right word. It was more wrinkly, meaning that it was losing its turgid. The cells were becoming less turgid, which means that it didn't have enough energy to try to open up. Because the more turgid they are, that's all how it makes the movement. There are no muscles in a plant. It's all about cells and how they expand and contract. So Spike here just did not have the energy to take it to the next level.
Well, when you say he didn't have the next energy, I'm sure you're going to be consulting and hobnobbing with your fellow arum growers. And what do you think led to that lack of energy? Does it have to do with the conditions under which it was grown?
No. It's a normal thing that we have seen. We know that was always a possibility in the back of your mind. We don't, what the percentage was, 5, 10% in the wild as well as in cultivation. I did seek out knowledge and consultation from other universities as well as Botanic Garden and Arboretum. And we all know that even in cultivation, they've all had some cases of where it didn't open up. So it was a known fact that it's a possibility. And it's all related to energy of the plant. Maybe the corm itself, the bulb, didn't have enough energy to fully open. It's like, you relate it to a tulip. You plant your tulips, but sometimes they don't come up with flowers. They only produce a leaf. And that's very similar to what happened here. We just don't know. It's Mother Nature. We can't look at, the conditions. We knew that we were giving it everything that it was needing, and then some. So
I assume that means that for this plant, it's going to go back. It's not going to try to flower for a number of years. It's done for now.
Likely. Just like in the wild, even it could be 5 years, another 8 years. We just don't know. But Spike is still alive. The corm is fine. We're going to let him go dormant after it starts to collapse. Bring it back. Well, in a couple of days, we'll bring it back to our production greenhouses. And when he goes dormant, we'll unearth him to continue the process to dry it out and weigh the bulb, as well as examine to see if there's any rotting or anything like that might have caused something. We don't suspect anything like that. And in another 2 months or so, he'll put up another leaf.
So is that a kind of good news, bad news thing, where if Spike had bloomed, was that the end of the plant? And since it hasn't, it will continue to live.
Correct. Had we were successful in our plan, is if it had been a successful blooming, we would have attempted the pollination. And if those flowers took after having developing fruit, it sucks the energy right out of the corm, meaning that it would be morphophytic, which that plant would have eventually died after the fruit was mature and we harvested the seed. So the good news is, yes, we still have Spike and we still have that corm going back into our collection.
And what are you holding right now?
I'm holding the spathe, which is a part of it. Part of it actually did break off when we took it off. We're going to have this on display so people can smell it and touch it and feel it and take pictures of it, and of course.
May I whip it? May I get a whip?
Yeah, here? The odor is more prevalent down at the base where the female flowers would be.
Yeah, not much, though. Right
not
now.
Much, but no. Over the last couple days, he was producing a little bit more odor than it was earlier in the week.
Yeah.
It's a lot more prevalent if you're right up next to it than where we are. But again, yeah.
Is your arm getting tired there?
Yeah, I mean, it weighs about a newborn. We'll watch and see. I think the procedure that we had to do is scientific to really find out what's going on and be able to kind of put an end to the story in the sense of knowing that Spike is still viable and we're going to get him back in our production and keep growing him.
So take me to the base of the plant there and what's left.
All the way around, yep. We have here these are the female flowers. So it's a ring of female flowers here. So these are the receptacles where the pollen would go in, just like a flower in your garden. They're typically sticky at the end. It's called a stigma. And there's a little bit of stickiness, and that's where the odor comes from. This ring here are the male flowers. They're not mature. Again, leading to the point that this that Spike was not having enough energy to fully develop. However, we are going to wait and see if they actually do open so that we can try to collect those flowers, the pollen, rather. Because that was the ultimate goal. This structure that we're seeing is an unusual for the public to see. Typically, they don't see it because the spathe would be attached and it would be covering all of that. The only time they might see it is when we cut the window to try to do the pollination. But now you can see the full structure. And again, that's a really good science story to this. In a couple days, the spadix is going to start to collapse. It already is up at the top. He's starting to sink in on himself. That's normal. Nothing indicates that there's anything abnormal here, other than the fact that there was not a development.
So as you say, it's taken some of the mystery out of what happens here, because you get to expose the flowers and the structure of the plant in a way that you probably wouldn't have before.
Correct. Yeah, which is a good feel-good, again, for our public to be able to see something. You don't usually see this because that spathe would be attached, and then it would close back up typically, and then within 48 hours, 72 hours after blooming, the plant would start to collapse on itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your time. This is Madden's here, and I know you're very, very busy, and congratulations on your science experiment.
Well, thank you. We have more. We have more, and hopefully very soon we'll have another one on display.
So the upshot is that Spike lives to bloom another day. And that might be in about a dozen years. Who knows? It might be sooner. It might be later. You can find more information at chicagobotanic.org or go to my website, mikenovak.net. I've got all the links and some photos there. That's all I got. Go green or go stinky.
You can find more information about the Mike Novak Show at mikenovak.net. That's MikeNowak.net for links, photos, and commentary.